us. All right, let's go.
Radio.com.
All right, on the line we have Jim Mascaro, the author of Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During the Financial Crisis. And Jim, you're going to square us away and make us all rich. Am I correct?
Well, I don't know about that, but I do want to thank you for having me on the show again.
Oh, our pleasure. Thank you so much for returning. I appreciate you sending me the email.
Well, I'm looking forward to hopefully a thoughtful discussion.
Okay. Well, what's happening? Can you tell us what's happening? You know, the markets are kind of screwy. You know, of course, it's going up. Most say because it's the cheap money. People don't know where to put them. You can't save money because you lose. It's negative interest rates, actually, in real terms. People don't know where to put their money, and most people don't have money. So, but the market keeps on going up, and for some reason, the talking heads on CNBC News and those idiotic programs seem to base the economy on the depth or the price of the stock market. What's your take on all this?
Well, you know, you bring up a lot of interesting points and really a lot of things that I agree with what you said. If there's a word that I would use to describe, and not just the stock market, but I would also say the credit markets to a degree, is the word is complacent. And complacency generally occurs when a market is near the end of its run. I'm not going to sit here and try to predict the exact point, but I've written some articles about that recently. And, you know, one of the things that I look at as contrarian indication is what do the advisors think about the market? I mean, are they overly bullish or overly bearish? And typically when they're overly bullish, it generally tends to indicate that we're much closer to a top than we are to a bottom. Yeah. And, you know, if you go back to June, the advisor survey that Investors Intelligence does noted a 62% bulls. And this really does count as an extreme reading. If you want to consider how extreme that is, consider that since 1987, so the great stock market crash in October of that year, there have only been three readings above 62%. The other two occasions were in 2005, which was near the real estate top, and then, of course, 2007, near the historic stock market top.
Right.
So we are, from an investor's advisor standpoint, incredibly bullish right now. There's another, I think, a very interesting financial index at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis in my town publishes, and it's called the Financial Stress Index. And that's a combination of measuring things like the VIX, which is a volatility indicator, looks at the S&P 500 financials, and about 18 different measures that really focus on interest rates and interest rate spreads. And that's really important because I mentioned earlier that we have a lot of complacency in the credit markets as well. Well, right now, we are, again, looking at some very, very historically complacent readings in that particular St. Louis Fed Financial Stress Index, which, again, if you want to look at it as a contrarian indicator, it tells us that we're much, much closer to a top than we are to a bottom.
Yeah. Well, you know, I sort of agree, not sort of, I do agree, with the likes of a Gerald Celente, who's the, you know, foremost world, I guess, trends forecaster, because he doesn't say, well, you know, come January this will happen, but he looks at trends around the world, and those trends don't speak very well for our economy or for the our income or for our productivity or even for the very social fabric. It seems that when we spout numbers, we spout them quantitatively, but not qualitatively. We say, oh, car sales are up, but they won't say why they're up. For example, they're giving the cars away or they're giving, you know, loans away to subprime. In other words, we only get the quantitative measure, but we don't get the qualitative measure. Am I on the right track or am I delusionary?
Well, and you're right. I mean, there's a lot of figures that get thrown at us. And unfortunately, I think in probably part of this discussion, I'm going to throw some more figures at you. However, these are figures that you probably won't hear about as much. Let's talk about maybe some of the qualitative aspects, but I'll try to affirm my statements with some quantitative data here. And so let's talk about something that's occurred, I guess, since 2009. So sometime in 2009, we were told, I guess, by the Bureau of Economic Research that the recession had officially ended. And so, you know, if you look at that, you know, again, on a qualitative measure, you think, oh, okay, well, that means that you know, there's more people working,
right.
You know, incomes are going up, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, one thing that's really interesting about the unemployment rate, and the unemployment rate as measured by the government has gotten better. Now, there's another measurement that's called, I think it's the U14 measure, which is higher than the published 6-point-whatever percent it is right now.
U14? I thought there was only U1 to U6.
Yeah, I think there's another one that basically that includes a broader segment of the population, so it's always going to be a higher percentage. But
okay.
But let's look at a qualitative thing. So we know that, you know, the government tells us that the unemployment number is better. Okay, so let's take that at face value. But there's another little interesting statistic. Again, this is quantitative, and it's called the civilian labor force participation rate. And what
right.
that tells us is of all of the people that can work, what percentage are actually working? And, you know, if you look at that figure, Joe, since 2000, that has been trending down.
Right.
2000.
Right.
And since the start of the recession in 2008, still trending very down. So if you think about this for a second, we've had a, quote, economic recovery since sometime in 2009, but you actually have fewer labor participants than you did before.
Yeah, what's that percentage, Jim? What's that percentage? Was it 52? I've got the number. I saw that one time, and I don't recall.
We're around 63%, and we used 53? To be at like 67%.
Right. Okay. You right. see, I fall in a special category. See, I work almost 24 hours a day, and I don't want to work, but they don't count that, do they?
Well, you know, I don't know how old you are, but I'm going to give you an interesting statistic. So,
sure.
I've heard that some pundits say, well, the reason that there's a lower labor participation rate is you've had all these baby boomers retiring, so they're not going to be working. Well, an interesting bit of research that I did earlier this year was, well, if that's the case, then the civilian labor force participation for those 55 years and over, okay, so those potentially could be retired, should be going down.
Right.
Well, guess what? That has not happened.
As
a matter of fact, since about 2005, their participation has gone up.
That's
and
right.
Since the end of the recession, they've been pretty much, you know, a little bit higher to around what they were before. So if you look at just 55 years and older, there's actually more or at least the same of those people still in the labor force. Now, you might also hear the argument, well, you know, what about people that have bachelor's degrees and so forth? Well, guess what? Their labor participation rate has gone down
right.
since the recovery. So, you know, you have, on the one hand, you have overall fewer labor participants. You have one segment that you have at least the same number of participants, the older folks, so to speak. And, you know, the having a diploma did not necessarily insulate you from, you know, for at least being a labor force participant.
Well, what's going to happen? I know those between the ages, I think, 25 to 45, labor participation is down, and it doesn't seem to be getting much better. And there seems to be a structural problem in our unemployment figures. In other words, we have people who want to work, and we have companies that want to hire, but they don't want to hire the people who want to work because they don't have the right tools, the proper degree, the proper experience. In other words, we have a mismatch, and I think some of that has to do with people getting easy government loans to go to college when before they may have maybe gone to a trade school, went to college and got a degree in sociology, and now they can't find a job. Am I off there, or what's going on around there?
I think you hit the nail right on the head, Joe. You know, it's interesting because I was doing some research for an article a couple of weeks ago, and I was looking at consumer debt. So what's happened to consumer debt since, let's say, the recession of 2008, 2009? Well, if you look at revolving debt, which is, you know, credit card debt, it's actually trended down, you know, noticeably since then. So people have kind of pulled back there. On non-revolving debt, it's actually gone the opposite, and it's actually increased. Well, that's interesting. Well, you know, what's part of non-revolving debt? Well, it's student loans. So, you know, now you have student loans north of about $1 trillion. As many of you probably that are listening know, that's not dischargeable in bankruptcy.
That's correct.
So you're always going to owe that to the federal government, and you're absolutely right. I mean, the cost of going to school now this is my personal opinion. Typically, when you have government greatly involved financially in some aspect of business, it'll tend to drive the price of that up. College education is certainly one of those. Healthcare, you know, is another. But there's a lot of people, obviously, that have gotten degrees that are not properly matched, to your point, to maybe the actual needs of the economy or to labor. And as a result of that, now you have, you know, some sense of structural unemployment and a large amount of debt to go with it. Now, you take all that together, all the things that I mentioned to you about labor, and this pool of educated folks with bachelor's degrees that are not working, well, it makes for some pretty significant, you know, a very ample pool of labor. And what that means with all of this labor available, that does not bode well for increases in wages. So there's actually some downward pressure on labor rates, and again, my estimation, because of some of these conditions that exist.
Right. Well, you know, there's one thing that I have not read about, we don't talk about, and it looks like we try to avoid, and that is the not the structural unemployment, but the psychological unemployment. In other words, we have young people who believe in their own minds that they have an education because they have a college degree, that cannot find a job, are highly in debt, not only to the student loans, but also credit cards, which they're addicted to, and maybe a car loan and whatever. And they don't see any way out. I personally know a couple of young gentlemen, nice guys, and I'm not a professional, but these kids are depressed and maybe suicidal. And I'm not saying that lightly. But they feel that way because when you hear them speak, there's despair in what they're saying. So this rips at the very fabric of society well beyond and has ramifications well beyond just the fact that we have an unemployment problem.
Well, and you know, you bring up a good point because the one thing or the one age group in society that can tend to destabilize it the most is what people that are, you know, that tend to be on the younger side, right?
Right.
And if you look at societies where the unemployment among, let's say, youth or even early adulthood people is high, it does tend to create a lot of potential instability. Now, the instability in this particular country is going to be mitigated because you have a social fabric that tends to catch people, a social safety net that tends to catch people. And you know, now we're up to about 50 million participants in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, a.k.a. food stamps. You know, so that's one level. You know, you had unemployment benefits that, you know, at some point got extended to 99 weeks. So, you know, we have something, a social safety net, that tends to mitigate some of the, you know, the effects of some of these structural unemployment issues that you mentioned. But that obviously has its own pressures, and that can't continue forever.
Oh, no. In fact, I think that's devastating. And I'll give you an example. I won't tell you how old I am, but I'm over 140. I want you to know that, okay? I'm that old. But when I was in high school, I went to a camera store on Gun Hill Road in the Bronx. And I love this camera store. They had all these fancy cameras. I knew nothing about cameras, but I was fascinated by a store. And I went in there, and this guy was named Ben. Ben, I think his name is Ben. And I said, I want a job. He says, I don't need anybody. I said, but I want to work here. He said, I don't need anybody. And he said, I can't afford, you know, to have someone else on site. I said, oh, no, I don't want to get paid. I said, I just want to work here.
Oh, hire
I want
guy.
To learn about cameras. I'll help you out, whatever. And don't feel obligated. Don't pay me. I'll come here and I'll work 3 hours, 5 days a week after work, and then I'll go home and do my homework.
Ambition.
And he thought, he said, you're kidding me. I said, no, you know. Now, I had to go back a couple of times. Eventually, he hired me, and that was my favorite job. And I never forget one time, I think I made the wrong change, and I screwed up the store, and he lost a lot of money on me. But no, he did. You know, I admit it, it was horrible. But I'm just saying that. But today, this guy would be serving a life sentence in jail. But I learned a lot about cameras. I helped him out. And you know what he wound up doing? Every Saturday, when I would come in for Saturday morning, I'd be there for a couple of hours, he would pay me money. And it was always a lot more than I ever expected. And I never asked him for a dime. Never followed and said, hey, you didn't pay me this week. Didn't want any money. And yet he paid me. And then I had a great Saturday night because I had money in my pocket. And everyone benefited by that. Today, everyone would be in jail. I would be on some sort of psychological rehabilitation program. He would be serving 20 years in jail. They'd close down the camera store. People wouldn't get their cameras back. I mean, society's gone to hell in a handbasket. What do you think, Jim?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was just thinking when you said you didn't ask for any wages and he paid you something. You know, he obviously made some sort of a conscious decision about what your labor was worth. Even though you're willing to work for free, he made a conscious decision about what your labor was worth. You know, today you have minimum wage laws, which there's been obviously more controversy about certain states, like I believe Washington, Oregon, District of Columbia, you know, asking for higher minimum wage rates. And you know, that's something that I think probably needs to be looked at in more depth, and not just from a political sense. And I don't know if our discussion will head into politics at some point, but this is something that I wrote an article about, which is, you know, there's a minimum wage, but guess what? In different states, it means different things. You know, South Carolina, you know, they don't have a minimum wage. State of Wyoming says it's $5.15. If you're in Oregon, they say, no, it's $9 or more. You know, the federal minimum wage right now, I believe, is like $7.25. And if you look at what's happened, and we talked about earlier about labor force participation and so forth, the minimum wage has gone up, and labor force participation has actually gone in the other direction. Now, I'm not saying that the correlation is perfect, but, you know, the fact that different states have different minimum wages and the federal minimum wage means something. I mean, it's very, very difficult if you think about it. So, I mean, let's just forget the argument about whether a minimum wage should exist or not. But I'll ask the person that says, well, yes, we should have a minimum wage. So my question to them would be, well, what should it be?
Right.
And that's a very, very difficult question to answer because
right.
the reality is there is no specific answer to that because it depends, right? It depends on, you know, how much labor
yeah.
output.
Well, for example, in my case, right. he paid me enough money so I can take Roseanne DiNapoli out, who sucked my face off, right? And yeah. she was. I tell you, this girl kissed me all over the place. It was amazing, you know? And I love going out with her because her brothers were big, strong, I mean, known guys.
Good
no
character.
One screwed with me if I was going out with Roseanne, you know? Anyway, it served a purpose. I was happy. She was happy. My lips were happy. Everyone was happy.
Let me tell you about a wage rate that would make somebody very happy. So I found a story. There's a town in North Dakota by the name of Stanley. Mm-hmm. It's only 2,000 people. It's on the northwest corner of the state. You're like, well, what's so important about that particular town? Well, there was an ad that appeared in Craigslist soliciting for like somebody that would deliver pizzas and make pizzas. Well, I mean, nothing unusual there, right?
Right.
But what was unusual was that they were projecting that if you worked a 49-hour work week along with, you know, some paid vacations, some bonuses that they would give you and, you know, tips, they estimated that you would make, get this, $56,000. Now, so you're thinking, well, why would a little bitty town in Stanley, North Dakota, of 2,000 people pay that much, you know, for making pizzas and delivering pizzas?
Right.
Well, I mean, it sits on the Bakken Oil Formation. So, you know, there's boom times going on there, right? And the economy of that particular area, the person, I guess, that owns that pizza parlor thinks, hey, it makes sense for me to pay somebody $36,000 in salary and then probably $20,000 in tips that they're going to get, a $56,000 package to deliver and make pizzas. Now, if somebody did that in St. Louis, Missouri, where I live, they'd think you were crazy, right? But nobody mandated what that person, that business owner, you know, needed to pay to make pizzas. It was the economic conditions that dictated. So whenever you hear discussions about minimum wage, I would just ask your listeners to ask the question, what should it be? And it's a very, very difficult, if not impossible, question to answer.
Well, yeah. And plus, this is Gary. I hate to butt in here, but I've got to butt in. You know, the who in the heck makes this person work for you anyway? I mean, do I go out and hold a gun to their head and say, you work for me for $7.25? You know, no one does. If you don't like it, go to someplace else where they'll pay you what you're worth. And if they don't pay you what you're worth, make the man is so embarrassed, like the gentleman that Joe worked for, that he'll pay you something even if you don't want anything because you're worth it. And you just embarrass him for paying you so little. And if he doesn't get it, somebody will get it because you're going to help his bottom line, and he will pay you what you're worth.
You realize what
it's
you're worth.
Yeah. That's the thing. thing. It's a very, very difficult. And see, nobody, whenever you hear these minimum wage arguments, they're generally politicized because they talk about, well, right, there needs to be a acceptable standard of living with this wage and so forth. So then my question is, well, should that, if it's an acceptable standard of living that we're looking for a minimum wage, then maybe it should be $20 or $30 an hour. Well, now all of a sudden, you know, if you're a business owner and the government says you need to pay somebody this minimum wage that derives an acceptable standard of living, and it's $20 or $30 an hour, well, as a business owner, you know, you have to make adjustments for that. You know, in I believe it's in the the country of France, the minimum wage is about over $12 an hour. Well, and then in McDonald's, what do? They replace some of their workforce with kiosks. You know, I've been to Walmart and Lowe's, and even some of my local grocery stores, and there are places, right, that you don't have to go and see a cashier. You can just do it yourself, right? So, you know, you have to be very, very careful about mandating things like minimum wage, because at some point in time, you're going to have business owners that are going to look to accommodate that, and one of the ways to accommodate that is going to be through automation, and that's obviously not right, something that will assist, you know, in labor force participation.
Right. Well, Jim, let me ask you, are people moving to areas of employment? In other words, are people going from Detroit, for example, where they can't find a job, and going to North Dakota where there's drilling going on and there's a need for labor? Are people moving, or are they sitting still because they figure, well, they can get some government assistance for staying put?
I know, and I don't have these statistics off the top of my head, Joe, but I know that there are some states that have experienced, a population drain. Right. We know that there have been some transitional population movements towards, you know, some of the Sun Belt, so to speak. But, you know, one thing that is going to lock people from moving right now is what? It's mortgage debt, right? There are, I don't know, I have 7-10 million homes, right, where they are still underwater. And the prospect of selling a home where you're underwater and taking into account real estate sale fees and so forth makes the proposition of moving almost impossible. So that migratory pattern that you might have had in the past right now is somewhat locked in by somebody that literally can't move because they can't afford to move because they may not have enough in savings to make up for the fact that they're going to have to pay off that mortgage that's going to be more than the sale of their house.
That's right. So that's right. People are really stuck, and they got thinking they were going to get rich on their mortgages, wound up being a bottomless pit for them. Jim, is your book still for sale, Escaping Oz?
It is. Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During the Financial Crisis. It's available at the Amazons of the world and Create Space. I could just briefly mention, Joe, because of some of this economic research that I did and some of the common things that I kept seeing was the word debt, and on a personal, you know, consumer level, but I also saw it on a business level. So I've started a boutique consultancy that helps small businesses with debt mediation and capital acquisition.
Okay.
We could probably do a whole show on some of the struggles that small business, you know, the true engine of job growth in America, some of the struggles that they encounter on a daily basis from all sorts of fronts, you know, not just, you know, the regulatory things that are imposed upon them now, but just day-to-day challenges of being in business. And so that's some of the things that I'm helping small businesses with when they run into debt problems.
Okay. Listen, on our internet program, I'm going to have you back, and we'll have a lot more time. Right now, I need to cut off because we're running out of time. Jim, I'd like to thank you very much for being on our program. Folks, this is Jim McCara. He is the author of Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During a Financial Crisis, and I do hope you'll accept our invitation to return at a later date.